In this hour of Focus 580, we have a guest here in the studio who is visiting the campus. We're fortunate that many people come and speak, and we're able to have them and bring them to a wider audience, outside of Champaign-Urbana. Our guest in this hour is Amina Mama. She is chair and professor of gender studies at the African Gender Institute at University of Cape Town in South Africa. She has taught in social studies and gender studies in a number of European and international institutions. She has a doctorate in organizational psychology from University of London and is interested in a number of things, including women in government and politics in a variety of African contexts, also other subjects, women's organizations and movements, militarism, and so forth. She's here in Champaign-Urbana to talk in the MillerCom series. She's sponsored here primarily by the Center for African Studies and Women and Gender in Global Perspectives program, and other people as well. Too many to mention, but I want to mention them, and also the MillerCom folks. And I'll let you know that she's going to speak at 7:30 this evening on the U of I campus in the Levis Faculty Center on Illinois Street in Urbana. And always, as always the case with these programs, that they're free and open to the public, and anyone who is interested should feel welcome to stop by. Here on the program, of course, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, but anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and we also do have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for giving some of your time.
It's a pleasure.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the idea of gender as scholars and academics talk about it, because obviously what they're talking about is something that is not a biological construct, something that is more of a social construct. And I know that there are people who have said gender, thought of in that way, framed in that way, they have said, well, that's a Western concept. It's something that's foreign to Africa, so that it doesn't really make any sense to talk about gender in that way in the African context. And maybe that's a place that we could start. I expect that you, in fact, would disagree with a notion like that, that gender operates in Africa in that way, just the same way that it operates probably every place.
Well, I'd certainly disagree with the idea, the argument, which is quite commonly made, that gender is a foreign concept, because gender is one of the key organizing principles of the vast majority of societies all over the world, including Africa. And as long as there are gender differences, and in most societies, gender inequalities, social inequalities based on originally biological differences, these are now extended over into unequal social relations, then you have a cause, if you like. Gender inequities and injustice serve as the inspiration for gender theory, gender practice, and women's struggles against those things. And I think that's worldwide. I think gender relations are differently organized in different contexts, so the sites of inequality are different in different cultures. But I think nearly anthropological work over the decades shows that most societies, if not all societies that we have known in human history, are organized around gender as well as class and other social divisions.
Mm. Are there some ways in which this issue, though, is different in Africa than it would be, for example, in the United States or Britain, just to name two other places?
I think every location in the world has its own cultural and social and political legacies, and these are distinctive in ways that are equally marked by gender. So, for example, there's a well-known example of parts of southern Nigeria where the practices of gender are organized in a way that's extremely different from Western societies, where women of high status in traditional society, the well-known example is that women of prowess can take wives. This is not something you find commonly in the United States, I believe.
No.
So that's an example. So I would say there are differences, and the way it's organized is always embedded in a given social and cultural and political history. Mm. So that it's contextual. There's no abstract universalizing form that gender takes. It's very much embedded in other social relations and realities and conditions. Hmm.
What sort of connections are there between gender and issues of gender and politics on the national level as we think about them? And I know people have said the struggle for political progress and political equality is tied to the struggle for gender equality as well. Those two things kind of go hand in hand. How do you see those connections?
I think they're definitely linked. The way in which the household is organized, for example, and positions women primarily in their reproductive and maternal capacities in many societies, that has some sort of carryover into social and political life. So that, you know, from the bedroom to the boardroom, it tends to be expected that women will make the tea. Boredom's supposed to be a professional space. Women aren't supposed to be performing nurturing roles. They're supposed to be performing professional roles. But you find this sort of instinctive, unless you intervene and change it, and sort of automatic carryover. So that applies to political life. In the vast majority of nation states, modern nation states, men dominate the political arena. They dominate the public arena. And if you want to draw a contrast between America, where, you know, women are often thought to be very much more verbal and in the public arena, and African contexts, you can look at the whole range within Africa. The most recent example that we're celebrating is Rwanda. I don't know if people here have heard about the election results there. As in many African countries, they put in a quota of 30%, but when they went to the ballot boxes, 48% of the people elected to the parliament were women. And this is a major shift. So there is still inequality, but there are notable shifts in certain African countries. Rwanda now has the highest representation in the world, I believe. It's gone beyond the Scandinavian countries and Mozambique, South Africa, Uganda, Ghana. All of these countries have had specific strategies for increasing women's participation in the formal political arena, and overcoming the baggage of tradition and the legacies of the colonial state, which actually excluded women, and that came from Europe. So I think Africa is quite progressive in this arena.
Well, now that you mention it, I'm curious about the Rwandan case and how it is you account for that.
Well, I think it's partly a popular reaction to the catastrophic events that have happened in that country.
To the genocide?
Yeah, no. Yeah, I suspect so. And the destruction, the decimation of Rwandan society, which was one of the most, according to the information I've recently come across, one of the most deeply patriarchal in Africa. And you know, the link between militarism and genocidal impulses and masculinity of certain kind is well established. And I think that there's a public popular reaction to the level of abuse and violence. And I think you're seeing similar developments in many post-war contexts. The question is whether those moments of rapid progress can be sustained. The experience of earlier national liberation struggles in Africa has suggested that it's very hard to sustain the gains that women make in the context of a liberation war, even if they join in fully participating, even in battles and military struggles. After the moment of independence and democratization, there's often a sort of restorationism, and men want to sort of remasculinize and reassert their authority in the old ways instead of pursuing the promise of the new moment and new directions.
Mm. Well, I suppose I could understand, or one could understand, that after a period of revolution, that what one would say one would like was to get back to normal life. And I suppose that means whatever you consider to be normal or normative when it comes to relations between men and women, that's what you go back to, and you say, okay, that was a special circumstance. Mm-hmm. And special rules, but now it's peace, and so we're going to go back to what we have known. And it probably has, may well have happened in Western societies as well, at least if you look at participation of women in the workforce.
Mm. The war times. There's that wonderful film, Rosie the Riveter, about how women were called into the factories and industries during the Second World War. And at the end of the war, the boys who survived came home, and it was, you know, women back to the kitchens and allow men to become, to remain in charge and back in command on the home front. So that's true of Western societies as well. The most recent African example, one of the recent examples, is of course Zimbabwe, where they made enormous gains. I mean, we were celebrating the change that happened when the present government first came to power, and look how that has been set back. Most of the legal reforms have been undermined by President Mugabe himself.
Yeah.
And in the current context of unrest, there was recently a conference on torture in Zimbabwe, which particularly highlighted the appalling abuses and violence that women on the farms are being subjected to in Zimbabwe at the present time. And that's a massive regression when you remember the happy images of women as fighters in ZANU-PF, women joining the new nation state in various prominent public capacities. But then this gradual attrition, which is something we need to take very seriously and understand.
And certainly in a lot of these places where there have been these armed struggles going on for change, where women have participated, there also have been women in leadership positions, now perhaps fewer of them, but women who were really well known and celebrated, heroes in their own right. How do people to think about them? And particularly, I guess I wonder how young women think about them, and whether they think of them as role models, or whether they say, well, I can't, yes, she was a wonderful woman, she was a very strong, great leader, but somehow, I can't be like that. There's no way that I could be like that.
I think we use such examples a lot in teaching younger women. It's a history that needs recuperating and documenting, and gender studies and women's studies has done a lot to keep these things alive in people's memory, because the natural tendency of male-dominated historiography is to sort of forget some of those interesting historical moments. So one of the kinds of work that gender studies does is highlight those and offer them as examples and illustrations of the diversity of possibilities facing women and indeed men out there as we move towards the future. So it's to encourage critical thinking, broader thinking, and I think they do serve. I mean, I can remember growing up in northern Nigeria, and the examples were Queen Amina of Zaza, a 15th century military queen, and these things were very important in shaping our identities at a time when there was growing constraints on women's mobility and a return to earlier practices of female seclusion and such like. So I think these examples are very, very important. Do young women find them daunting? Yeah, perhaps. Sometimes. I think it depends which kind, you know, which young women you're dealing with, and indeed how the examples are put to them. But they're very important to recall and to remain in the collective memory as we look at our options.
It's from what I read about you in your childhood, it sounds as if you were didn't have quite a typical traditional upbringing, at least in the sense that your parents thought education was very important and they encouraged you in that, and you weren't exactly following the traditional girl program. You were a little bit pushed the envelope a little bit, I guess, as we would say.
Well, I like to say that tradition is always diverse. In West Africa, there's a very long tradition of women's education that goes back to right through the 20th and into the 19th century. African women from that part of the world have always embraced education. It's varied from one culture to another, and what appears out here to be the most stringent Islamic culture that has pervaded northern Nigeria over the last couple of centuries, it also had women, great women teachers, figures like Nana Asma'u, whose life and work has recently been documented by an historian. So there's always a mixed picture when it comes to tradition. But I think my family were particularly liberal and particularly invested for our particular location in northern Nigeria. It was not that common. More common in southern and eastern Nigeria and Ghana, Sierra Leone, Where I grew up, it was not normal, certainly not to go right the way through tertiary education the way I did.
Yeah. Our guest here in this hour of Focus 580, Amina Mama. She is chair and professor of gender studies in the African Gender Institute at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, and is visiting the campus, going to give a talk tonight talking about gender studies in Africa. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What do you see as the connections between what happens on the level of the university, where people talk as university professors and students do about issues of gender, the connection between that and what happens outside the walls of the university, and what some people might say was the real world, the connection between the academic world and the outside world?
Well, I'd probably begin to answer that by noting that the university in Africa has always been very much a part of nation building and regional development. We didn't have the same sort of monastic male tradition of scholarship that one can trace in European civilizations. So I'd say that we've never really had the ivory tower in the pure sense, much as maybe that's something worth envying, maybe it isn't. From a feminist perspective, I think one would definitely say, well, those ivory towers were very much male towers, phallocentric towers even, so perhaps we wouldn't be interested. But so broadly speaking, I'd say the university has always been strongly linked into political and social developments. The vast majority of African governments have made particular efforts to recruit, co-opt, and indeed use African intellectuals in pursuing their agendas. So that's the first thing I would note about African universities that perhaps distinguishes them from some of the more exclusive academies in the West.
We have a caller here, and certainly I would welcome other people who are listening, if you have questions for our guest, to give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The caller is in Belgium. That's over by Danville, neighboring community here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Earlier in your conversation, your guest mentioned something about a group of people in Africa where the women can take wives. Would you like to expound on that just a little bit? That sounds very strange to me, and why that would culturally come about. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call.
There's a detailed study on this by a colleague of mine called Ife Amajume, which I'll refer you to. The title of it is Male Daughters, Female Husbands. And so I'm drawing on that. I think the first thing I would note is that the construction of what the meaning of marriage is very different, and very much linked to production relations. And what the example illustrates isn't so much a sexual relationship between women, as in a lesbian relationship, but a contract, if you like, in which a woman who has accumulated sufficient wealth can recruit the labor of younger women and indeed be responsible for their children. And it's a traditional practice. I think it's something that's becoming far less common in as modernization occurs. But I pointed to it really to illustrate that marriage, gender, parenting are differently arranged in diverse social contexts.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would certainly have to be a group of people who would feel comfortable with the idea of a woman having that kind of power.
Yeah, and it's not something that all women enjoyed, and one could argue that the woman who commanded other women's labor and resources wasn't necessarily any kind of feminist or indeed egalitarian in her treatment of those. On the other hand, you could argue, as one does when one is looking at ordinary heteronormative marriage, that it offers some women an opportunity for security and self-development and self-realization. Mm. But I wouldn't want to romanticize it as an institution. It's just one of those traditional practices, of which there are, I would hasten to add, a great many. In fact, this one has received much more attention than other other practices that illustrate really the flexibility of man-woman relationships in different places at different times.
Well, again, we're almost at our midpoint here. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What does feminism mean in Africa, and do you think that it means something different to you, for example, or to other African women who would identify as feminist? Does it mean something different to them than it would mean to a woman in Britain or the United States or Germany or France or, you know, someone from the industrialized world?
Yes, I think that it's one of those broad concepts that captures a multiplicity of meanings, and it's, if you like, I mean, broadly speaking, it's the struggle, the practice and the theory that seeks to advance the liberation of women from male domination, to put it simply. But beyond that, there are so many different definitions, and I would say that feminists in every different context give it their own importance and meaning. Like gender inequality, feminism being the response to it, it's something that's embedded. To be meaningful, it has to be embedded in a thorough analysis and understanding of the particular social, political, economic, and indeed personal history and context. So it's a valuable concept because it's a traveling concept. It can have different meanings in different places. And then it's a socially holistic concept because it can speak to personal relations and personal senses of identity, masculinity, femininity, at the micro-political level. But then it also has great reach because you can use it to describe social relations, political relations, economic relations. So it offers us ways of making those connections between personal change and political and social change. And that makes it a very powerful tool in terms of theory. And offers people a way of thinking and being differently if they choose to embrace it at that kind of personal level and philosophical level.
I certainly think I would have a sense of what an American woman who identified as a feminist would, the things that would be important to her, that would concern her, things like reproductive rights, equal pay for equal work, the ability to do what she would like to in terms of career, access to higher education, maybe interested in a kind of egalitarian quality in her relationship with her partner, and, you know, a number of things, women's participation in politics, and so forth, and that's just the things that come right to mind initially, and there are probably a lot of other things. When you think about, to you, what are your important issues? Are they the same, or are there in important ways in which you would say, well, there are some things that are same, and yet there are some things that I would say that are different?
Mm. At a broad level, I think every one of those things that you mentioned would affect women in African contexts. The detail that would differ, the meaning of reproductive rights is very different in societies in which probably, if you take a country like Mali, the primary concern of women would be the right to deliver babies safely. Maternal mortality there is extremely high. The health infrastructure is extremely poor. So if it's a right, the right to, which I think it clearly is, the right would be to have safe and secure facilities that enable women to carry out their reproductive function. In other contexts where those things can be more taken for granted, the focus would be different. Contraception, the right to contraception may feature more in some societies than in others. I think it's something that women would seek in most societies, given the chance. But the salience of the different things that make up a sense of reproductive autonomy and rights would vary. And the same would be said of equal pay. I can remember in the early 60s, 70s, when women in the West were marching for the right to work, black women in the West, and indeed African women, thought, God, if only we could work a little less. Women have always worked in most of these societies as farmers, as traders, as entrepreneurs, as well as all the usual domestic labor. And in poor and underdeveloped contexts, you're also speaking about the old hewing of wood and carrying of water. Mm-hmm. So what we would seek would be probably the right to less work. And I remember reading of an Italian group who were arguing for the right to leisure, for women to stop work and become great artists. I think that's a very appealing idea, but it's a long way off from what we would struggle for in the workplace. We would be looking for less sexual harassment, less intimidation, better pay. And that's very much a reflection of the conditions that are prevailing in poorer economies and in countries that have had a long history of exploitation and labor exploitation and women's labor being exploited along in multiple ways.
Hmm. What about, I guess one thing I'm curious about is simply in daily relations between men and women and how they relate to one another and what they think about that, to what sort of rights and responsibilities attach to that relationship and, you know, who does what and just, you know, who makes the decisions. Is that a kind of thing that people think about?
Well, I think when you go down to that level of detail, the first thing one must do is avoid making generalizations. Mm-hmm. And that's particularly so because there are a lot of stereotypes out there about African men, about the way they live their personal and private lives. And so that's the first thing. And then some of those things you find here in terms of there being misconceptions about how middle-class men as opposed to poor urban men live their lives. And one of the observations I would make in looking across, I think particularly West African societies, is that poor urban men often play a role in domestic work. They just don't advertise it. So you can, you know, stumble upon men washing pots, and more is done than is made out. Mm-hmm. So I would want to attack the stereotypes and say all kinds of things happen in different households and in different class groups and in different, and we really have not done enough detailed study of the way in which people organize their lives, and then it's a difficult thing to study because most men do not want to say that they do these feminine things, so it's likely to be disguised. I'm an optimist. I think men do more than they make out, although I think it's fair to say that the broad picture is one in which women are carrying an inordinate amount of domestic and reproductive labor in Africa, as indeed elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the role that class plays, I think, is very interesting and something that here we don't often acknowledge. Perhaps we don't quite know how to talk about it, in part because we like to believe that there is no such thing here, while very clear that there is. And there can be vast differences in people depending upon their class, the socioeconomic resources that they have to put into their life.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways in which this complicates things is if you're an affluent family, you don't need to engage in struggle over who's going to do the dishes because you just hire a maid, probably some woman from some underdeveloped country who needs the money. But so the exploitation, if you like, is passed on, and relatively well-off families don't have to engage in struggle, which is why I gave the example of your poor urban working-class man possibly doing more than is conveyed, because there isn't so much of that capacity to mitigate it by hiring somebody in, and that these conditions make it very different. I mean, I know differences in terms of domestic work between West Africa, where During colonial times, it was predominantly something that men were hired to do. And South Africa, where I now live, where this has always been something that African women are hired to do. So straight away, in terms of domestic service, you've got a gender difference across two different parts of the continent. So these things vary with the local history, and it's about the interaction between local cultures and whether they would allow their women to go and serve other people or valued them so much and their labor so much that they kept it within their own households or and so on. So there are many conditions that impact on domestic organization.
Well, you introduce an idea that we haven't talked about, and I think is also important, and that is the way that the colonial experience also has shaped attitudes about women, men and women, gender, and so forth. Because here we had traditional societies that were perhaps, came with one set of ideas and one way of doing things. And then here comes Europeans, and they turn everything upside down and to the extent that they can reorder things the way that they want them to be. Has that experience, that experience in so many places of colonialism, left its mark on the things that we've been talking about here?
I think it's left a very profound mark. Again, one must be careful about making generalizations, but if you think about colonialism and what it was primarily initially mercantile and then militaristic, and it was very, very much a masculine and masculinizing project. The people who went from Europe and other places to places like Africa were predominantly men, and they carried out the colonizing project and the extraction of resources, including human resources, in very violent and unpleasant ways. And it was partly a masculinizing project. I mean, there are some lovely, you might not say lovely, some rather interesting and not always pleasant examples in the scholarship on, the literature on the period. And one that comes to mind is an anecdote it's actually a fact, where the British colonial officer, a chap called Mr. Hall, is commenting on the need to change Burmese society and to make real men of the men, and his recommendation for that was to create a local army so that the men could learn to be real men and the women could be put back into something he regarded as more normal. So colonialism was definitely a masculinizing project, and the colonial state, as I noted earlier, was an all-male affair. And indeed, you could say that legacy is probably partly responsible for the prevalence of military dictatorships at a certain time in Africa's independent history. If the colonial state was set up to rule, I think it was Ruth First, a South African academic, who once noted that the colonial state was a despotic state that was designed not to rule for the people or by the people, but despite the people. Mm. And that I think has marked African statecraft. I wouldn't want to overemphasize it because clearly there have been some changes, but the ease with which many African countries slipped into military dictatorship during the 70s, I think, owes something to that kind of history, where the state apparatus that was set up was actually incompatible and intolerant of civic involvement or popular concerns, and actually the officials were groomed to disrespect the people that now, with democratization, we want them to represent. So there have been baggages, the encumbrances as a result of the colonial impact, and you could take any major social institution and do a reading of those.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe just a little bit more, and I'd like to introduce again our guest. Amina Mama is Chair, Professor of Gender Studies in the African Gender Institute, which is at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, and she is here visiting. We'll be talking about gender studies in Africa as part of the MillerCom series. That's tonight, 7:30, on the U of I campus at the Levis Center. anyone interested should feel free to stop by. And here on the program, anyone interested in being part of the conversation can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that people have looked at issues of development and have talked about that, particularly when it comes to things that can be done to improve the quality of life for women. It seems that the thing that they argue for first and foremost is education. That is, that women get the opportunity to have education, and that a number of other things will follow from that, and a general sort of improvement in their status and their ability to have some control over the course of their lives. It seems to almost follow automatically. Now, I know that's a kind of idea that some other scholars, particularly some fairly conservative ones, have called that into question, but well, whether in fact that's true or not. And that's the way that you, if you're going to do development, that's sort of a bedrock thing that you start with. And I wonder what you think about that, whether in fact you would agree with that idea that a key to improvement of women's lives, a fundamental thing, is giving them the opportunity to have education.
Well, I think the sort of quick answer to that is it's a necessary minimal condition. But it certainly doesn't automatically translate into equal relationships in the society. Highly educated women can be subjected to quite extreme forms of oppression and abuse. So while it may widen the set of opportunities and certainly the professional and career opportunities, sometimes that doesn't translate into full equality. But having said that, I think within the African context, the majority of universities were established post-independence, and at that point, formal exclusions of women were ended. So there has been a steady flow of women into tertiary education, and countries like Nigeria and Ghana, with quite large higher education sectors, have produced tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of educated women who you find now in universities all over the world. So I think that it definitely has produced results, and women are the first to seek education. If you go to any rural community and give them the opportunity to say what they would like, it may be wells and water pumps, but it's very likely to also be literacy and the right to read and to seek an education for themselves and for their children. So African women have been deeply committed to pursuing education. But having said that, the institutions of higher education in particular have remained deeply unequal places for women.
That here we're maybe coming back around again almost to the place where we started, and this touches on the subject you'll be discussing tonight in your talk. As a way of opening that door a little bit, what sort of challenges do people who are interested in seeing this happen, that is having, gender studies be a strong and viable part of the university program, what sort of difficulties do you face?
Well, it's an area that's grown, but that growth has been in the context of a massive decline in African higher education, for reasons that we probably don't have time to go into in detail. But alongside that decline in the sector, there's been, the internationalization of feminism. There's been a growth in gender activism all over the world. And, right the way back to the 80s, there's been a growing awareness of the need to do something, to intervene. And that's something that we must do. Goes beyond just opening the doors. 30 years of open, apparently free access have left us with unequal access. Only 6% of the women enrolled in the Central African Republic universities are women. That's the worst end of the spectrum. The highest is, strangely, two countries, Libya and Swaziland, have just over 50% women enrolled. But the norm is around 25%. That's what you find in Ghana and Nigeria. And after over a decade of affirmative action, 35% of the people enrolled at Makerere University are women. So broadly, we're still very much a minority. And that's just at the point of entry. What it means to be a woman pursuing higher education in Africa is further complicated once you get in there, in terms of the disciplines. It's more acceptable for women to do certain kinds of study than others, so we have a very serious underrepresentation in all the prestigious fields, the sciences, medicine, law. These are still bastions of male predominance. And the institutional cultures present major challenges to women who want to seriously pursue scholarship. And those challenges are made worse in the context of poverty.
Mm. Why just, I realize it, and it may be complicated, but since you mentioned it, I'm curious about what's happening with higher education in Africa and why apparently it's not doing well. Is it a resource issue?
Very much a resource issue. If you look at the massive growth in the sector since independence, that shows you how, if you like, African governments and the African public have always been deeply committed to it. We grew from, I think, less than 5 universities at independence to over 316 today. So there's been massive demand and some degree of commitment. But since the economic downturn, most African states have come under increasing international pressure, very much driven by the World Bank in the 80s, to say that Africa could not afford a luxury such as higher education, what we should be doing. And this is in the context of the idea that Africa just must attend to the basics and actually doesn't need highly skilled people. The emphasis was very much on pursuing basic literacy, and the higher education sector was then faced with massification and growth in the context of increasingly constrained resources. So while the number of people entering higher education grew to well over 1 million being enrolled every year, by the mid-90s, the resources that made books and other key, you know, necessary tools of the trade available declined. So we have that strange contradiction between massive demand and desire for it and an impoverishment, which has really dramatically brought about the deterioration of all our great, formerly great centers of higher learning. And this is something that there are a number of initiatives underway at the moment to try and begin to redress and rebuild what at one time was a much more vibrant sector.
Mm. We have a caller here. I want to make sure we get them in before we find ourselves out of time. Here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, this will be brief and maybe with no real answer to it, but trying to pose a question within the framework what you've talked about. The thing that comes to my mind when you talk about gender and you talk about feminism, and then if you add Africa to it, it seems like it would be, you know, somehow, in my mind, it's more basic. So I've got a question about a basic issue when it comes to the problems between gender, the two genders. And that is, men always think, you know, women bear children, and like that's their natural role. But when you come to the other half of the equation, it seems like men are kind of at a loss to figure out what their role really is. And I was just curious if in Africa, you've talked about how there's so many diverse roles culturally there, if any of them seem to have answered this a little bit better than most, and maybe your opinion or anybody else's opinion, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, thank you for that basic question. I'll begin by saying that actually women do not have children by themselves. Men do have a role in this and in the reproduction of future generations, and I think I'm amongst those, and I would like to say that many men feel this way too. Actually, it's a lot of important, valuable, and enjoyable work raising children. So I would invite and encourage men to participate and partake of the pleasures of being a parent, as I know many men out there do. And I think what we are critical of is that kind of extension of a biological fact that women get pregnant and give birth right the way across our lives. These days, women live longer. They spend fewer and fewer years being pregnant than what our grandmothers did. So we also are interested in pursuing other things. So my sort of final remark would be simply to acknowledge that and encourage it. And I don't think any society's got it right. I could share personal experience to say that in African countries, perhaps because there's no welfare and there are very few creche facilities, my experience of raising young children there was very much strengthened, and I'd like to think improved, by the willing availability of many other members of my family, whether they were cousins, nieces, nephews, aunts. Living in Western contexts, there seems to be a little bit less of that availability, and I think it impoverishes children. Children, I'm a romantic, I think children need many, multiple adult figures who care for them and nurture them, and isolating parenting either with one person or just even just two people is really depriving children of the opportunity to learn a great deal more about the adults that they're surrounded by and who run their lives for them.
We're pretty much at the point where we have to stop. There are many directions we could go in, but I think perhaps we'll leave it at that with our thanks to our guest, Amina Mama. She is a chair and professor of gender studies in the African Gender Institute at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. And we'll be talking about gender studies, strengthening gender studies for Africa's transformation. That's the title of her talk for tonight, 7:30 in the Levis Faculty Center on the campus on Illinois Street. This is a MillerCom event. They're always free and open to anyone who would like to attend. Well, thank you very much for being here.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you for all the interesting questions.